I started walking toward the barricade, playing the role of some badass hombre. Why I'd chosen this moment to be a showman, I'd never know. For on the other side stood a very wary East German soldier holding an AK-47 submachine gun. More accurately, this mean-mouthed Volpo was training an AK-47 on my precious body. It had been a long time since a weapon was pointed at me in earnest. It got my attention. In my mind, I flashed to Trieste, to that day I heard a jug patrol moving through the valley on the Yugoslavian side of the whitewashed border. I'd squatted on the ground and duck-walked my way down the hill toward the thin white line, sweeping the valley floor with my binoculars. At first, I'd seen nothing of interest. Then I saw nothing at all, as a man stepped out of the woods directly in front of me and blocked my view. I put down the field glasses. The jug soldier was a couple of feet away, just across the line. The only thing grimmer than his expression was the sight of the barrel of his submachine gun pointed right at me. I was unarmed. In my early sergeant combat find-em-fix-em enthusiasm, I'd unconsciously inched much too far from my weapon. I slowly got to my feet, heart and mind racing through very limited options. It was high noon Cold War style. I kind of gave the guy a smile and slowly reached into my pocket. I pulled out two cigarettes, lit them, and offered one to the jug. He didn't refuse it, but he didn't let his weapon drop either. We smoked in silence for a very long minute. Then, with a nod, I turned my back to him. Heart in mouth, I walked over to my abandoned rifle, picked it and my helmet up, and kept on walking up the hill. Looking back, though, that had been easy. I'd been alone. Now, with a readied AK-47 burning a hole in my chest and the eyes of my guys burning a hole in my back, I couldn't exactly offer this Volpo a cigarette. So, albeit scared stiff, I kept walking. Poker bluff, I thought. I've got jack shit in my hand, but I'll raise him the pot. Finally, I got to the evolving wall, and with one glaring eye on the Volpo, I kicked the concrete part as hard as I could. It was a stupid, frivolous act. If the guy had shot me, an American soldier, we might have had World War III on our hands. As it was, I think the East German was as surprised as I was that I'd done it, so I just gave him what I hoped was another hard glare, turned around, and walked back to my Jeep. And as the guys slapped my shoulder and congratulated me on my balls, I just held my breath until we'd driven away and the wall was out of sight. Things in Berlin settled pretty quickly. I reorganized the company into two rifle platoons and one weapons platoon to counter the manpower shortage. About 2 weeks later, we'd get a slew of replacements to bring us back to full strength. We were stood down from our full-time alert after a week, with the duty rotated around to other units. There were a number of confrontations at Checkpoint Charlie, usually with Soviet and American tanks rolling right up to the gates, playing chicken. All such incidents caused general alerts, but fizzled before a shootout. Quite fortunately, really, given that if we'd gotten into a real firefight in Berlin, our longevity, to quote Tim Grattan, would have been about 5 minutes. The Volpos sometimes used mirrors to reflect sunlight into our cameras and binoculars, a weird weapon that was right out of the Bible, where shields were used to blind the enemy. They also used water cannons, but not necessarily with water. One 1st of the 18th Patrol got hit with a load of night soil, a.k.a. human shit. Colonel Couch's retaliative suggestion for that was to zap them with atomzite grenades, which produced a host of unpleasant though temporary effects, including severe nausea. The counter-effect worked, and the East German night soil assaults ceased once and for all. Meanwhile, letters of commendation praising our move to Berlin were pouring in from President Kennedy on down. The Berliners, calling us liberators and saviors, showered any man wearing the 8th Div patch and the 1st of the 18th green and white fourragère with all the love and affection in their hearts. The 6th Infantry got surlier and surlier over all the attention we were receiving. Inevitably, this led to some tremendous fights in clubs and bars around town. The 6th guys would grab one of our men by his fireman's rope, the fourragère for leverage, take a swing, and it was on. Colonel Johns counseled the battle group to use restraint, personally shared the nightly duty with Colonel Couch and other field grade officers of roaming around the trouble spot and making his presence known, and even talked to the 6th's COs to put an end to it. When nothing helped, he gave permission for his boys to let fly. Unbeknownst to the friendly enemy, a couple of guys in the 1st of the 18th were karate black belts, and before Berlin, unarmed combat had been part of the training schedule. So when our boys let loose, they were like a buzzsaw running amok through the 6th Infantry's ranks. Soon after, the two permanent party battle group COs got with Colonel Johns to find a better solution, and much of the violence stopped. Happily, Company D played little part in all this mayhem. The worst of it sprang from the fact that the 1st of the 18th was co-locating with the other battle groups and stealing all their girls. Over at Tempelhof, our only competition were the Flyboys, and because the little Fraulines who milled around the base were equally enamored with them, there was hardly any friction at all. In truth, there shouldn't have been any to begin with. The ratio of girls to guys in Berlin was 7-1. It was a soldier's paradise. I knew we were on to something when I saw the ugliest guy in my company, a short, dumpy albino kind of guy with scars and boils all over his face, strolling through Tempelhof like Valentino with a Prussian beauty on each arm. Guys like Ed Savetix and Tim Grattan were as straight as the arrow on their 8th Division patches, but the rest of D Company's officers were bachelors, and they took full advantage of it. The players and strayers among the married officers in the 1st of the 18th came to Tempelhof for their dalliances, far from the eyes of Johns and the rest of the staff. As for myself, Berlin was simply a belated conclusion to the journey I'd set out on with Al Hewitt 15 years before. "This is the army of occupation in Germany, Al. You've got to join up," I'd say to myself from time to time, wishing my dear old friend were with me to help cash in on all the ping-pong balls. It didn't take long for word to get back to the wives in Mannheim that the married liberators were taking too many liberties of their own. Johns intervened on behalf of the ladies, organizing R&Rs for them with their husbands in Berlin, the unstated rule being that the Tempelhof Officers Club was off-limits, or letting each of us go home for a few days. One of the married NCOs in my unit got his chance to go home the morning after his Berlin girlfriend planted a wicked hickey on his neck. When he came to me for advice, the only thing I could think to do was call in the medic for some emergency surgery. The doc took a scalpel to the angry red blotch, made a first-class wound out of the thing, ripped it on barbed wire, the guy could say bravely, and bandaged it up. Apparently, the ruse worked, because the guy came back still married. And that was no mean feat, in that the divorce rate within the battle group skyrocketed during our stay in Berlin, as did marriages between troopers and West Berlin girls. One of the most successful American ladies' men in Berlin was a brilliant young Army aviator captain named Dale Leclerc. 24 years old, short, solid, and built like a bull, Leclerc would have been among the top three on my list of animals I have known. I met him through Jerry Heilman, who had been one of his flight school classmates, and we became good buddies despite the fact that, even by my standards, Dale was an absolute wild man. He'd stand in the officers' club sipping a martini. When he was through, he'd eat the glass, just nonchalantly stand there and crunch it down to sand. It was a good trick that must have taken some time to master. In the interests of showmanship, I tried it once only to cut all hell out of my lips and tongue. But since all my boys were there, I had to keep on chewing and pretend it was perfectly natural for me to be slugging down the booze with blood gushing out of my mouth. Dale Leclerc's unparalleled success with the Fraulines was most likely the result of his imagination and his extraordinary charm. He'd fly his chopper over the Berlin lakeside beaches, for example, throwing out leaflets that read, "The handsome young man flying this helicopter is Captain Dale Leclerc. If you would like to meet him in person, ring him at," with, of course, his phone number and the best time to call. These things would flutter en masse onto the tanned bellies of the West Berlin sunbathers, and the results were mind-boggling. Once I went back to his apartment with him, only to find a line of girls waiting patiently at his door, all of them ready to live the day as if it would be their last, the prevailing philosophy among most West Berliners at this time. Dale didn't know a single one, but with both good judgment and generosity, allowed a few to introduce themselves to me. Sadly, he had to abandon that particular airborne promotion scheme when one of his leaflets landed on the lap of the Chief of Staff's Berlin Command dependents. She took it home to her daddy, who failed to see the humor of it. As part of the Berlin Aviation Detachment, whose basic purpose was to fly VIPs along the Berlin Wall, Leclerc was permanent party at Tempelhof and responsible for all the helicopters there. One afternoon he did a favor for an elderly Berlin-based civilian photographer, letting the guy take a bird's-eye look at the wall. Berlin reporters were not authorized on U.S. Army aircraft, but by any stroke of good luck, Dale should have gotten away with it. He didn't. As the chopper tooled around in the air, it was fired upon, a single projectile crashing through the bubble of the aircraft. Had the flight been authorized, this incident would have been yet another serious east-west flashpoint. Since it wasn't, the warrant officer pilot reported nothing and hightailed it back to Tempelhof immediately. Upon Dale's investigation, the damage had come not from a bullet, but a bolt, which some East German must have sent up with a slingshot. Dale got a new bubble for the chopper, swore everyone to secrecy, and that was the end of it. A week later, the unauthorized flight became an international incident. The warrant officer let the proverbial cat out of the bag, and who did what to whom, and why the hell was that chopper up there in the first place, were just the preliminary queries in an investigation that involved everyone from Dale's CO up to the highest levels in Europe, if not to the president himself. It didn't do wonders for Leclerc's career. He received an Article 15, non-judicial punishment, and, to my great disappointment, was removed from the Berlin Command. The bolt incident was only one of a number of potential flashpoints in the early days of life in the physically divided city. Another was TV personality Jack Parr's visit. In this episode, 80 U.S. soldiers in full battle gear plus 7 U.S. Jeeps armed with machine guns and recoilless rifles came rushing unprovoked up to Checkpoint Charlie. As cameras rolled, they were joined by 7 officers, and while the Vaupos looked on anxiously from the other side, Parr began his razzle-dazzle report on the ground with the troops. The public information officer of the Berlin Command was relieved by Theater C.G. Clark in the wake of this cops and robbers affair, which the info officer had organized, and which the Pentagon later called a disgraceful episode, and the battle group CO who provided the troopers was admonished. All of us played hard in Berlin, but the 1st of the 18th worked damn hard, too. The unit-wide issue of M-14s took place only days after we arrived. We turned in our M-1s simultaneously, so despite the Helmstedt reprieve, we still found ourselves with unzeroed weapons in what was considered a combat zone. We got priority on the lighted KD ranges and zeroed them at night. I hadn't zeroed a weapon at night since Camp Drake in Tokyo the night before I shipped to Korea for the first time. Then it had been cold, and I remembered how awkward it was to zero my M1 wearing the gloves I'd been issued. Of course, now it was late summer in Berlin, with warm, balmy nights, so there wasn't really much to the exercise except a nice bit of nostalgia. After the M14 changeover, serious training began, and for all our fire and maneuver field troops, and most of the officers as well, it was a whole new ballgame. Riot control, fixed bayonets, skirmish lines, bullhorns, tear gas, and feet stomping on cue was pretty boring, particularly since the only potential riots in West Berlin were between the U.S. units stationed there. But combat in cities, the next block of instruction, was great. The Berlin Command had built a complete mock city for this training. I'd learned much of the stuff as a private in Italy, fighting door to door, using grappling hooks to climb up buildings, employing snipers and grenades in a city environment. But I quickly learned that the view of the one being employed is dramatically different than that of the one doing the employing, so as a company commander, I got a hell of a lot out of the instruction. The 6th Infantry were experts in both city fighting and riot control. Despite their palace guard flabbiness, they proved able teachers. Still, to prevent their becoming too cocky, A while later, we fought them in a tactical field exercise in Berlin's Grunewald Forest and whipped their asses, in the process rekindling their outrage at our very presence in their city. There were few good training areas around the airbase for field exercises, but we made do. In direct contrast to the Manhattan Beach community, the Berliners, who were right into anything military, loved watching us train. And we put on a pretty impressive show, with Savetics singing a mean version of When the Saints Go Marching In during our runs, and the company chiming in on each line at full voice, without missing a step. PT was designed as much for fun as to work up a good sweat. Sometimes I'd challenge the guys to beat me in push-ups, and we'd do hundreds, until none but the studs were left. It was the same with the runs. On one occasion, I gave the order to go for broke, and while most of the group fell out at 10 or 12 miles, the studs kept moving. In the end, the only ones left were Adderley, Grattan, and Savetics, the jocks, me, and the hardcore mother of them all, Sergeant Sweeney. We continued night training in a limited way. One of the first exercises was a company night attack across the runways of Tempelhof. Consideration for all elements of the maneuver was taken into account, or so we thought, until simultaneously with the Red Star cluster shooting into the sky, signaling the commencement of the attack, and my 200 men dashing across the airstrip firing blanks, a commercial jet came roaring into Tempelhof on its final approach. The pilot thought the airport was under attack, and he pulled out all stops and zoomed off to abort the landing. Naturally, a lot of people, not least of them the pilot, were a bit upset about infantry playing cops and robbers on the online runway, and the next morning Tim Grattan, who was the training officer, was summoned before the TAFB command. "I was scared to death," he reported when he returned, "but when I saw the infantry CIB on this Air Force guy's chest, I knew we weren't going to be too far up Shit Creek." He was right. We had our wrists slapped, and thereafter coordinated our night maneuvers a little better with the airbase authorities. Failing that, I'd send Big Ed Savetics over after the fact to smooth things out. "Thank God it only lasted 3 months," Ed would later say. "I used to think it was your way of keeping my weight down. I lost a few pounds off my backside every time I made a call." The comparative freedom D Company had in Berlin resulted from time to time in little lapses in discipline, even among the more solid young soldiers in my command. One of these guys was an E-4 I'll call Jack Fry, who was reported AWOL early one morning. It was a pretty straightforward case. The rumor was he'd fallen in love and was shacked up in the British sector of the city. The easiest course of action was simply to wait, and when he returned, court-martial him, but I didn't want to do that. As a kid, I'd come in late off a pass a few times. The only difference between Fry and me was I never got caught. The boy, he was only 19, was not a screw-up. In fact, he was a damn good soldier with a lot of potential, and my gut feeling told me not to use him as a horrible example. So instead, I authorized a 3-day pass, had someone forge Fry's signature on the sign-out roster, and asked his own platoon to go out looking for him that evening. Of course, if he'd been found floating face down in the river overnight and was now lying in a morgue somewhere, it'd be kind of difficult to explain how he managed to sign himself out, but I kind of felt the odds were on our side. When Fry strolled in later that day, he was brought to my office. "This won't go on your record, Fry," I told him. "I could bust you, but I've decided to turn you over to Sergeant Sweeney instead. He'll determine what your punishment will be. But let me tell you something, young soldier. I just laid it on the line for you. You owe me one. You've got the potential, so don't screw it up." The boy agreed to smarten up his act, and I never had any trouble with him again. He was always a bit of a wise guy, but that was probably another reason why I liked him. Soon after this incident, and the funny thing about it was, little did I know when I saved Jack Fry's ass that a decade later he'd save mine, I decided to make acting sergeants out of a number of my E-4s until we got some E-5 allocations in the battle group. Another of Chief of Staff Taylor's black shoe innovations had been to abolish the rank of corporal and replace it with the specialist system, A stupid, stupid move in that Corporal historically was and should have remained the first rung on the NCO leadership ladder. There were about 8 guys due for promotion. I gave it to all of them, save Fry. He was fully qualified, but I wasn't going to reward a guy who'd just been laid off a pass. At the weekly inspection, just hours after the promotions were announced, Fry stood at a stone-faced attention. "Fry," I said as I inspected his weapon, "I was thinking about promoting you to acting sergeant too, but I really think you're too young." "Well, if I understand it correctly, sir," the E-4 rejoined immediately, "you were a sergeant when you were 16. He was off by a couple of years, but he got me. I guess I was a softer touch than I'd thought. As soon as the inspection was over, I had the first sergeant cut Fry a promotion order too. I always tried to give guys the benefit of the doubt. Generally, I worked on the baseball principle. 3 strikes, you're out. But now and then my hair-triggered temper got the better of me. What followed then was like a period of temporary insanity, though the rage itself was justified. And at times like these, I could do absolutely anything. On the battlefield, this fury was a gift. At other times, a definite liability. When, for example, during a general alert, our attached truckmaster staggered in late, which was very serious in itself, and drunk, which was inexcusable, if the whole company hadn't been assembled there, I probably would have pistol-whipped him to a bloody pulp. Only some unconscious survival mechanism stopped me. Instead, I stood the truck sergeant at attention in the middle of our hangar, whipped out my loaded .45, and thumped it on his chest while I chewed his sorry ass to shreds. Grattan told me later the guy wanted to press for a court-martial, until Sweeney and a number of other non-coms counseled him that it would be a pretty dumb thing to do. The guy was lucky to have people like that around. My own counselor was Tim Grattan himself, who, when I was about to go half or fully crazed over a trooper or a policy, would just shake his head and with a grin declare, "Sir, I think you're pissing in the wind." And it was so much better to leave the dirty work to Sweeney anyway. Not that I couldn't have done it as well, but to my old army brain it was more appropriate for an NCO to shape people up. When a guy missed reveille one morning simply because he'd drunk too much the night before, Sweeney tasked Fry and another sergeant to get him out of the sack and bring him to the mess hall. Being a good first sergeant, Fry explained later, Sweeney wanted the trooper to eat before he disciplined him any, so he put the guy in line. The kid took a tray, put scrambled eggs right on it instead of on a plate, and dumped a cup of coffee over the eggs. Then he went over to sit down at a table. Needless to say, this made the first sergeant awfully mad, so JJ, Sweeney's nickname when the troops spoke about him but never to his face, braced him, facing against the wall, and told the kid to stand there and eat. The kid said something smart to him, and JJ told him to turn around. He did. So now the guy was standing there holding the tray, and JJ just hauled off and hit the tray from the bottom right up into the kid's face. Scrambled eggs and everything went flying all over the place, and all the German KPs went running for cover. Then the first sergeant had me and the other sergeant take the kid outside, where we took turns running him until about 2 or 3 hours later, when he literally dropped to the ground, and we had to haul him back over to the barracks. The net result of Sweeney's NCO discipline was not a demand for a court-martial by an aggrieved screw-up. Instead, the kid did a 180-degree turnaround. Like Private Russell in the 77th, he became a damn good soldier. And since that was what being in the Army was all about, the moral of the story is that experienced, hard-assed NCOs like Sweeney are not, by design, brutal, unfeeling individuals. They do not break soldiers for the hell of it. They know what a trooper will need when the time comes, and if they break him at all, it's only to rebuild him again with a stronger, life-prolonging foundation to support him when the bullets begin to fly. Of course, the NCOs police themselves, too. "Well, how's it going, Top?" I might ask Sweeney. "Looking good, sir. Any problems?" "No problems at all, sir. I thought I smelled something with Sergeant Misfit yesterday." "He's been corrected, sir. Everything's under control." Generally speaking, this worked just fine, but now and then there'd be a guy who'd managed to defy correction. One of these was a buck sergeant I'll call Keen. This small, heavily built guy was a marginal squad leader, a troublemaker of the First Order, and had a reputation for abusing troops. How bad he was, I didn't know until the afternoon I was walking through the company area and saw him beating holy hell out of a refrigerator-sized cardboard box. I thought he'd gone crazy. "What's up, Sergeant?" I asked. "I'm giving a soldier discipline, sir." I asked him to open the box. He did, only to reveal a soldier cowering inside as though he was waiting for the next blow. This was not discipline. It was victimization, and kind of a revelation for me. I hadn't seen anything quite so sadistic since Charles burned that South Korean papasan's beard off in G Company many years before. I made a pledge to myself then and there, my complete trust in the non-coms to take care of their own notwithstanding, to keep a sharper personal eye on the goings-on of any reputedly unsteady NCOs. The only thing in life you can be sure of is you can't be sure of anything. When the Army Times published the promotions list and my name was not on it for the whole world to see, not only was I humiliated, but I was completely and totally crushed. At first I thought there'd been a mistake. I read the thing again and again. Everyone tagged for promotion to major was listed, and my name just wasn't there. I couldn't understand it. I'd been promoted to the permanent grade of major only months before in the reserve, and had had nothing but glowing ERs since, and to be passed over. I was heartbroken. Fortunately, I was in Munich when I found out, having been summoned to appear at Harold Borger's grand jury. Within 24 hours, I'd be back with my unit, struggling to keep a brave face, but with Patty, who joined me for the court appearance, at least I got over the initial shock. We went to the court and sat outside while I waited to be called to testify. Patty was sympathetic, supportive, and truly wonderful throughout, but my misery over the Passover was only compounded during the wait. All the deception I'd been through with Harold came back with a rush. At least it would be the last time we'd have to be each other's two-faced friend. I was sorry he'd been so stupid, and that I'd been the one who recognized it. Finally, they called me in. Harold, as impeccable as ever, was sitting in the dock. "Hello, David, how are you?" he asked. "It's lovely to see you." I nodded, but couldn't look at him. "And how are Patty and the girls?" "They're fine, Harold, just fine." "Well, give them a big hug for me, will you?" "Sure." With that, I took the stand and testified against my friend, the spy. 6 months later, Borger would be the first American ever to face the West German Supreme Court for espionage. Then he'd testify that his motives were pure, that he'd spied for East Germany solely to further the cause of Israel, believing there was a revival of anti-Semitism and militarism in West Germany, and that he'd meant no harm to the United States or West Germany themselves. There was no evidence at all to back up his claims. He was found guilty and was sentenced to 2.5 years. Where he went after that, I'd never know. I never saw him again. I left Patty, who had proved once again, just as she had at Fort Sill during the show cause investigation, to be the epitome of the solid, steadfast Army wife, and headed back to Berlin, just a passed-over captain. Worried that my troops would find out their stud CO was a failure, that they'd see my disappointment and my heavy, heavy feet of clay, I worked overtime, being cheerful, while in fact, I went on a bender that lasted for days. I told no one save Dick Coker, who stood by during many a drunken night to provide whatever support he could. I found out only later that a number of my men knew the truth from the first day, but mercifully kept it to themselves. Meanwhile, Colonel Johns started pulling strings to find out what had happened. First he called an old buddy, Colonel Beverly Rock Reed, who was working with the Chief of Assignments for Infantry Officers. From Reed came the news that I'd not been passed over, which was a relief, 2 passovers and you're out of the service, but under a new system was deemed fully qualified but not selected. The reason, Colonel Young's 9-year-old ER rendered after 40 days observation of me when I was 21, which stated I was impetuous and immature. Colonel Johns was furious. Always looking after his boys, he fired every cannon he could get his hands on, while Colonel Reed took the case before his boss, Brigadier General Reuben Tucker, a much-renowned World War II regimental commander with the 82nd Airborne, Johns turned to USAREAR CG Bruce Clark. General Clark started pulling strings of his own, and when Tucker approved Colonel Reed's recommendation that my record go before a special board of study, it promised to be a pretty smooth road. In the meantime, I stopped bleeding, shook off the enormous blow to my pride, and finally got my ass wholeheartedly back to work. When Maxwell D. Taylor, JFK's personally selected military representative of the president, decided to visit Berlin, Colonel Johns designated Company D as the airport honor guard. Under the new style of army leadership, this sort of thing would have been a nightmare. Under Johns's old army command style, it was a dream. No staff officers came prowling around for pre-inspections. Johns himself gave me the mission, "Put on a show for him, will you? Right by the book. And if you need anything, just holler." And I didn't see him until about 10 minutes before Taylor arrived 4 days later. "How are you doing, Hack?" he said. "Just fine, sir. Would you like to inspect the honor guard?" He glanced toward the 80 stud force I'd culled from the company. "No, they look good to me." Then he paused. "On the other hand, I'll tell you what. Why don't I just put the boys through their paces?" "Right, sir." He strolled over to the honor guard. "Hut 10, hut!" he bellowed like a drill sergeant. "Present, Harms!" The men quickly complied. "Order, Harms!" Johns grinned. "Stand easy, boys." "Well, that's fine," he said with his gentle drawl. "Throw me your rifle there, son." "I mean, throw it." The kid he was addressing hurled his M14 at the colonel. "Now, gentlemen," Johns continued, catching the weapon easily, "it's been a long time since I did this kind of thing, but when you're doing the drill, put a little extra snap into it." With that, he whipped that weapon around as if it were a 2-pound cane, each movement with complete precision, as though he'd been doing it every day of his life. "See what I mean?" he asked offhandedly as he tossed the rifle back to the trooper. All the boys were working hard not to smile. Johns had that effect on them. He was so obviously in love with his profession and his troops that just seeing him in action was an inspiration, and it seemed as if everyone admired him. A lot of times troopers would come to my office and ask to see him. "Oh, shit," I'd think. "What now?" "Can I help you, Sergeant?" I'd say. "No, sir. I want to see the colonel." "It can be arranged, but I don't think it would hurt for you to tell me what's on your mind." "Yes, sir. My wife had a baby last night. Little boy. I want to tell the colonel. We're naming him Glover Johns." This happened all the time, particularly among the black guys in the outfit. Johns was just a stud and a charmer who knew soldiers and soldiering even better than his namesake's names. And it was that very thing, his total confidence as a leader of men, that gave us the room to breathe, to fail, and to grow. A screw-up honor guard for Maxwell D. would have done little to advance Johns' career, but the colonel trusted me enough to know I wouldn't blow it. And, of course, I busted my ass. The honor guard stint went off without a hitch to make sure he was right. Trust. That magic word was not dead after all, at least while commanders like Johns were around. We left Berlin before Christmas, replaced by a 24th Division battle group out of southern Germany. There was no fanfare, just a cold, cold morning to remember the Cold War city by as we retraced the route we'd taken some 3.5 months before. The Soviets had dubbed the reinforced U.S. presence in Berlin military hysteria. We'd ignored them and stayed on, as would the 24th, to remind them of our military strength and commitment to Berlin, while life in the West's side of the divided city pretty well went back to business as usual. The building of the wall had provoked one of the chilliest moments of the Cold War, but considering everything, it was just a political game. After all, our presence didn't stop the wall going up even 1 minute. And had there been a serious confrontation, our forces wouldn't have stood a chance, a fact just as obvious to the White House as to the Kremlin. The thing about the wall was that despite Khrushchev's big offensive threats in the years preceding his decisive act in Berlin, the wall itself, as any soldier should know, was a defensive concern. It wasn't defensive in a strategic war-making sense. It had not been built to prevent the West invading Soviet-controlled soil. Berlin had been like an hourglass, the people of East Germany flowing to the Western sector relentlessly, like grains of sand. And no matter how much the Soviets narrowed the aperture, the people kept on coming. Every day we were there, East Germans tried to escape, and the Vopos, besides the scores who made the break themselves, tried to stop them. At least two were brutally slain swimming the 50 yards between East and West across the Teltow Canal, shot in the back by East German soldiers. Double strands of barbed wire along the canal bank had closed that escape route, but it didn't matter. The determined still found a way, and always would. The Berlin Wall was simply an exceptionally effective monument to the failure of the communist people's system. Khrushchev had solved his problem, but at a very high price. At the checkpoint coming out of Berlin, my unit was inspected by a Soviet captain. The Russians were mad people and truck counters. We'd gone through the same drill, governed by provisions in the Potsdam Agreement, on the way in, de-trucking, lining up in files, and waiting for the okay to keep moving. Though I'd thought these inbound checks had been without incident, when we reached Berlin, I heard one quite amazing story involving a member of one of my squads. The rule was that though the Reds could make us unload and reload any time they wanted, and though they could inspect the contents of our vehicles at will, they were not allowed to touch the vehicles themselves in any way. Apparently, a Russian third lieutenant, too short to adequately inspect one of the trucks, had stood up on the tongue of the attached trailer to get a better view. One of our Spec 4s, an old World War II guy who'd been a master sergeant but never seemed to be able to hold his rank, thanks to the three-day binges he went on every time the Eagle shit, and who was sitting in the truck by the tailgate, had hauled off and butt-stroked the Soviet in the face with his M1. The third lieutenant landed bloody and dazed at the feet of his boss, a colonel. Everyone in the truck had figured that this was it. Hello, World War III. Instead, the Russian colonel had jerked the boy to his feet and dragged him away behind a building, where he chewed the lieutenant's ass to borscht at the top of his voice. What had interested me most about this episode was that despite the overall tension, despite the Soviet bombers' too-close-for-comfort provocative overflight and the Vopo and Soviet guns tracking us the whole way up the East German corridor, that Russian colonel, the guy on the ground, had been in no hurry to start a big confrontation. Still, as I saluted the Red officer now on our way out, I just hoped our Spec 4 would not give an encore performance. "Sir," I said, "my unit is ready for inspection." The captain returned my salute. He was a small guy with high cheekbones, almond-shaped eyes, and thin, determined lips pursed tightly together. As we walked toward the company, I noticed he could not take his eyes off my pile cap. He was wearing one, too, of similar type, but the fur was almost blue. I thought maybe it was the paratrooper wings or captain tracks pinned to mine that had grabbed his attention. So I took the cap off and offered it to him. He put it on and gave his to me. He finished his counting, each of us wearing the other's hat, and told us we could go. Then he looked at me, and for the briefest instant, he smiled. And in that moment, there was no Cold War. We were simply the day-to-day custodians of someone else's suspicions and fears. We were just two soldiers, trapped into hating each other by the roles our countries had ordered us to play. We traded hats again, and the 1st of the 18th started the long trip home. It was uneventful, all things considered, except when one platoon of Captain Rosenstein's E Company somehow got off the Autobahn and took a scenic drive through East Germany. Colonel Couch, who was traveling with Rosie's unit, decided to halt the column, and while the boys took advantage of this unscheduled comfort stop, a Soviet lieutenant colonel tasked to monitor the withdrawal pulled up on the scene. "He laughed," related Couch, "got on his radio and told the Russian command we'd stopped to wet." XO Charlie Rogers offered the guy an Irish coffee, which, according to Couch, he really put away. When Couch asked him about the missing platoon, the light colonel cheerfully said they'd taken the wrong turn and were going in the other direction. Even before Rogers poured a second shot of coffee, the Russian officer had agreed to take Rosenstein with him, and together they'd bring the missing element back to the main column. The stragglers, unharmed and intact, were ultimately rounded up on the road to Dresden. It was no big mystery who'd get the Fugawi Award that week, and put back on track. The Russian had been good to his word, and considering him, the Soviet colonel who'd chewed out his third lieutenant, and the Soviet captain who'd worn my hat, it kind of made you wonder what all the hating was about. When a green West Point or ROTC lieutenant joined D Company, I always had Sergeant Sweeney or another of my old Army NCOs sit in on my first conversation with him. "Glad to have you with us," I'd say. "Looks as if you have a fine record from the academy. But let me tell you something. Now, I don't want to upset you or anything, but you don't know shit about soldiering. You see old Sweeney here?" Sweeney's name is used here as an example only, as this great NCO was field first now, operating on a company, not a platoon level. I gesture to the sergeant sitting across the room. When I was a little kid, Sweeney was a platoon sergeant in Sicily. Dropped with the 82nd. Is that correct, Sweeney? "Yes, sir." "And he fought that platoon from Sicily to Normandy and all the way to the Elbe, where he met up with the Russians. Isn't that right, Sweeney?" "Yes, sir." "And when you were a little kid, Lieutenant, Sweeney was commanding a platoon in Korea. Matter of fact, he's been an infantry platoon sergeant for how long, old man?"
22 years, sir."
22 years. Now, when you're a full colonel, Lieutenant, and you're sitting in the Pentagon with your feet up on a desk, getting fat, and your kids are little, or maybe even grown up and going to college, old Sweeney will still be running a platoon somewhere. Don't you think so, Sweeney?"
"More than likely, sir. Can't think of anything else I'd like to do."
"So, Lieutenant, I think it's fair to say he knows more about infantry than you will ever know. So what's going to happen here is Sweeney's going to be your teacher. He will command the platoon, and you will follow his instructions. You are not commanding shit. Don't give orders and confuse things. Just do what he says. When he's ready to let you command the platoon, he'll let you know. Do you understand?" By now, the lieutenant's face would be ashen white.
"Yes, sir,"
he'd say, his perfect military bearing marred only by a meek and trembling voice. "Okay, Sweeney, take him away." The kids were always shocked, but it always worked, and was a technique I used with Sweeney or a guy just like him in every command I ever had until the NCO Corps was bled dry. Becoming a competent infantryman is no overnight transformation. The toughest job in the U.S. Army is that of a rifle platoon leader. This is the guy who is at the cutting edge of the whole war, yet historically, the platoon has been led by the most inexperienced and thus the most incompetent guy in the chain of command. Even if a guy comes in with talent, it still takes 5 or 10 years of really hard work to get the knowledge and develop the skills to the point of second nature. General Patton is reported to have said that an officer needed 10 years of troop experience before he started to earn his pay, and some never did. In the case of the new lieutenants in my company, the old, seasoned NCOs always treated the greenhorns with the respect due their rank. "Look, sir, this is how you do this," as they taught them all they knew, but at the same time, and as important as the teaching, the lieutenants developed an abiding respect for the role of NCOs in a unit, and for the NCOs themselves. It was something they just weren't taught at the academy or through the ROTC program. On the other hand, there were a lot of things not taught to the enlisted guys about the officer world, things that might have been kind of helpful to know. And one thing that long bothered me after my commissioning in 1951 was the zero preparation I'd had to make an easy adjustment from EM to officer rank. In D Company, a number of soldiers wanted to go to OCS. Since I was the one who made the recommendations, I figured the best thing to do was give these eager beavers a shot at command. And while I took the opportunity to assess their potential, they could get an idea of what being an officer was all about. In the regular Army at this time, a squad leader generally had 12 or so years in the service. For my program, I organized a provisional squad that one OCS hopeful at a time would run. We'd feed the guys the basics, and then we'd observe his leadership style in action. If we thought he had what it took, he'd next become the company's training NCO.
In this role, he dealt directly with me, the rest of the company officers, and the senior non-coms. This gave us the chance to find out what made the guy tick, and because I was right on top of training, there wasn't one detail I didn't want to know, it was pretty easy to determine how efficient and capable he was. The program was not authorized, but it worked quite well, and to my great pride, a number of men who'd been through it went on to Benning and became honor graduates in their OCS classes. Sergeant Hartman was one of these OCS hopefuls. From all the facts on my desk, this heavy-built but fit former Marine seemed a shoe-in for the Benning assignment. But something about him always made me uneasy. To start with, I didn't like him. To me, he was an apple polisher and an ass-kisser, and he approached soldiering like a kid playing war on the back lot. He'd done a competent job in the squad leadership phase of our program, though, and in fairness, I'd had to bring him in as my training NCO some months before. By the time we left Berlin, I'd had it with him. More than once, I'd caught him in lies meant to cover numerous training screw-ups I'd already noted. More than once, I'd come back to my office to find him sitting behind my desk, wearing an officer's camouflage scarf and smoking a big long cigar. With his skinhead haircut, he looked like a piss-weak Mussolini. "Who the fuck do you think you are, Hartman?" I'd say. "John Wayne?" Hartman had proved himself super ambitious, in itself no crime, but with a power obsession that spelled nothing but trouble. I felt he was the kind of guy who, once he got in charge of troops, would initially abuse them and ultimately get them killed. So the day finally came when I told him he wasn't officer material. "You can stay on as a sergeant or transfer out," I said, "but you're not going to OCS from my company." Hartman didn't take it very well. In fact, about 2 weeks later, he went AWOL, and a few days after that, his uniform was found neatly folded on the bank of the Rhine River with a letter to Colonel Johns. Its message was pretty straightforward, something like, "Dear Colonel Johns, I've committed suicide here in the river because Captain Hackworth is an unfair, no-good prick who wouldn't let me go to OCS. Now, had Johns been anyone else but Johns, I probably would have been in serious trouble. As it was, he called me in, and when he realized I wasn't actually responsible for the guy's death, it pretty well ended the matter. But Hartman's body was never recovered, and I kind of blamed myself for his death. I did a lot of soul-searching. Was I just too hard? Maybe my personal feelings unfairly overrode a proper assessment of this guy's worth. On the other hand, if he'd jump into the river over not being appointed to OCS, God only knew how he'd have coped with the stress of being a leader in combat. Still, it bothered me for about a year, until the day I came across an Army intelligence memo that had reported a deserter, my old buddy Sergeant Hartman, had been apprehended in America. The story was he'd never jumped into the river. Instead, he'd caught a merchant ship home from Bremerhaven. Then apparently his mother got so sick of having him around her house that she reported him to the MPs, and they in turn threw him into the slammer where he belonged. Colonel Johns and Couch had a thing about company mascots, and after Berlin, we all jumped on their spirit-building bandwagon. Coker's B Company got theirs first, a bulldog they aptly named Big Bad Johns. John Ward's Charlie Cougar Company brought home a huge old alley cat that could fight like its namesake, in keeping with Ward's favorite expression, sustained superior performance. And D Company had to think quick. I asked my guys what the deadliest creature on Earth was. When they reported it was the cobra, I asked what could kill a cobra. The answer was the mongoose, and before long, Mongoose Delta Company had a stuffed mongoose living in the orderly room, its teeth sunk deep into the neck of a full-sized stuffed cobra. It was a real class act. Unfortunately, I barely had a chance to get used to seeing it there, because in early January 1962, Colonel Johns transferred me out of D Company to take over the battle group's combat support company. I hadn't expected another company command. It would be my eighth in the last 10 years, and as exciting as the prospect was, I was somewhat ambivalent about it. I hated leaving my unit, just as I'd hated letting go of the Raiders and Fighter Company in Korea and C Battery 77th Arty in California. When you work hard and see improvements, when you get to know your troops and watch them grow, you can't remain unattached. Your outfit is not just the best outfit, it's the only outfit, and it becomes hard to imagine your life outside or beyond it. On the other hand, there's not much better in the world than a challenge, and combat support would certainly be that. Since I didn't have much choice in the matter anyway, I chose to look at the bright side, and after turning command of Mongoose Delta over to recently promoted Captain Ed Savetix, I moved across the company street to start sweeping out my new home. The unit was in good shape when I arrived, with damn capable officers and NCOs. All they needed was a little tightening up. Combat Support Company was composed of anti-tank, radar, recon, and maintenance platoons, as well as a 4.2-inch mortar platoon, which, commanded by a captain, was virtually a company within a company. Each platoon had organic vehicles, and the troops had grown accustomed to driving everywhere. They had to be reminded they were infantry foot soldiers first and combat supporters second. But it was easy. Essentially, all I did was walk in, explain my SOPs, most important being the emphasis on basics, and let the guys get on with the work. I brought Robbie Sterling Robinson, my RTO driver, over to combat support with me, and over time managed to grab more studs from D Company to round out the team. I inherited some fine young men with the unit, too, most notably Lieutenant John Jack Peppers, the SPAT platoon leader, who reminded me of Eisenhower, the soldier, not the president, somehow, and whom I made the mortar platoon leader soon after my arrival when I realized the captain in charge there was less than adequate for the job. It was a decision I was never to be disappointed with. All too soon, Colonel Johns received orders back to Berlin as chief of intelligence. Most of us had known the magic couldn't last forever, but it didn't change the fact that we were incredibly sad to see him go. On 15 January 1962, the battle group fell out smartly for its final review before our favorite soldier. The weather was bitterly cold, but no one noticed. We were all too busy standing tall and greedily soaking in the colonel's farewell address. Johns was a leader who taught by example, so most of the points he made weren't exactly new to us. But to hear in a single speech this great man's basic philosophy of soldiering was like being let in on the secret ingredients of some magical formula. To wit, strive to do small things well. Be a doer and a self-starter. Aggressiveness and initiative are two most admired qualities in a leader, but you must also put your feet up and think. Strive for self-improvement through constant self-evaluation. Never be satisfied. Ask of any project, how can it be done better? Don't over-inspect or over-supervise. Allow your leaders to make mistakes in training so they can profit from the errors and not make them in combat. Keep the troops informed. Telling them what, how, and why builds their confidence. The harder the training, the more troops will brag. Enthusiasm, fairness, and moral and physical courage, four of the most important aspects of leadership. Showmanship. A vital technique of leadership. The ability to speak and write well, two essential tools of leadership. There is a salient difference between profanity and obscenity. While a leader employs profanity, tempered with discretion, he never uses obscenities. Have consideration for others. Yelling detracts from your dignity. Take men aside to counsel them. Understand and use judgment. Know when to stop fighting for something you believe is right. Discuss and argue your point of view until a decision is made, and then support the decision wholeheartedly. Stay ahead of your boss. When Johns had finished, Colonel Couch gave the order to pass in review, and company by company, we marched by with just that little extra precision, our shoes, uniforms, and brass earlier attended to provide just that little extra sparkle. As was the custom, the company commanders peeled off after their units passed the reviewing stand and congregated nearby for a final goodbye. Our moment with the colonel was delayed by the 8th Division CG, Andrew Goodpaster, who had replaced General Dolman in October. The minute the last company passed in review, Goodpaster grabbed Johns off the stand and began to chew his ass over something to do with the police of the post. Johns had watched the parade with tears in his eyes. The tears remained as he stood at attention while this prancer, who obviously hadn't heard a word of John's speech, berated him in front of us, totally oblivious to what this day meant to the colonel. Perhaps more couldn't have been expected from this engineer presidential aide to Ike, now managing an infantry division, but we were appalled. Later, Johns would write to me that good pastor's behavior that day was so incredibly thoughtless that it made him wonder at the man's ability in anything that requires subtle thinking. On the other hand, Johns continued, maybe that's the only thinking he can do, as he damn sure couldn't lead a squad of real soldiers to the PX for a cup of coffee. Johns' biggest problem, in his own words, was his uncanny ability to alienate my immediate superiors. In World War II, he'd told his regimental CO he was a stupid son of a bitch when Johns' unit was having the shit kicked out of it, and the CO refused to support him with tanks or artillery. To add insult to injury, then Major Johns next violated the chain of command and personally called the Div Arty commander to organize the firepower he needed. In Korea, his attempts to reverse the dangerous apathy that had accompanied the slide into trench warfare put him in constant hot water. My OER for that war was hardly a world beater either. In Berlin, his stealing the glory from General Dolman and the 8th Div staff didn't go down too well at all. In effect, all we got was a kick in the ass for being good, as witnessed that after-action report that had not one kind word for what we did, only gave criticism for the tie-up at the gas point. When I pointed out that an after-action report, the way I understood it, was supposed to enumerate all that was done right and all that was done wrong, and the lessons to be learned as a result, I got a very snotty letter from good pastor calling me contumacious. I didn't even know what the word meant, but have about decided that it should be my middle name most of the time when dealing with dumb shitheads in the rear. Colonel Couch later told me what the farewell ceremony confrontation between Johns and good pastor was all about. The problem had actually begun when we first got back from Berlin. In our absence, half our buildings at Coleman Barracks had been given away to a reserve tank battalion which had been brought over from the U.S. to reinforce the division during the Wall Affair. This was clearly unacceptable, and Johns, as senior CO and installation coordinator, had moved everyone around until we got back our fair share of the post. Colonel Gershenow, CO of Heidelberg Post, of which Coleman Barracks was a satellite, who'd commandeered our buildings to begin with, was not impressed. Next, when Johns and Couch, who before Berlin had daily provided one of the first of the 18th's rifle companies for the police of the entire post, decided, the devil with that, and insisted that all units within the caserna take their turn at police detail, the colonel responsible for housekeeping had gone bitching and moaning to good pastor. The result was the obscene farewell ass-chewing by the reviewing stand. Still, despite what had seemed an immediate obscenity to all of us waiting to say goodbye to the colonel, it was nothing compared to the venomous, petty, faint praise good pastor and his ADC, Brigadier General William Rawson, offered in Colonel John's permanent change of station efficiency report. Though the colonel was well-groomed, well-grounded, vigorous, and self-confident, with an exemplary military appearance and an unusual ability to inspire his officers and men and to obtain maximum response from his unit, well demonstrated, remarked good pastor in one of the understatements of the year, when his battle group was sent to Berlin with no prior notice, Johns also remained aloof from operational detail and close personal supervision. On occasion, applied himself less diligently to his role as installation coordinator than desirable, and with some neglect of important details and ancillary or supporting activities. Internecine warfare, Colonel Couch would later say, of Colonel Johns' relationship with certain powerful men up at division. I think they were a little jealous of his capabilities. They didn't like his personality. They couldn't come up to him as a leader and a soldier, and I think it galled them. Or, in Colonel Johns' words, I drove hard and raised hell when I didn't get what I wanted. I made waves. I bitched about supply procedures. I fought for my men if I thought them unjustly accused by a higher HQ. I fought problems too hard. From a love of my men, as opposed to someone else's men or my own boss's interests, because I had identified too closely with them due to my World War II experiences. I think I saw too many men killed and bled too deeply inside, with the result that I was overprotective. Overprotective he may well have been, but Colonel Johns translated his love for his men into the one thing that would save them when he was not there to wield the sword himself. Good, realistic training, esprit de corps, and high morale, or unabashed cockiness, some might say, within the units in his command. And while guys like Andrew Goodpaster and William Rawson made their way up the glory ladder, gaining 4 stars and the attendant influence, while Lyndon Johnson inherited the presidency and then won it too, it's been said that a long-time family feud, perhaps even a class war, between the Johns and Johnson families in Texas was the only thing that prevented Johns getting his first star on the spot in Berlin. Glover Johns, of the non-world-beating ERs, was destined to retire right where he was, as a colonel. "I hung on," he later wrote me, "even though I knew I had no chance for promotion as early as while we were in Berlin. I did so because I found it hard to believe, and because I just plain liked what